This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show talking with somebody we've had on the air before. Marty Grothy is a retired psychologist and management consultant. He's a lifelong quotation collector, and we've talked to him before about his collections of quotations that he's published several books now. I think this is his eighth, because his newest book, just out today, Deconstructing Trump, Donald Trump and the Trump Phenomenon Through the Lens of History. Marty joins us from his home in North Carolina. Thanks for being with us, Marty.
It's always nice to talk to people back in my home state of North Dakota.
So let's talk about the title, Deconstructing Trump.
When you and I, well, I'm a lot older than you, but when you and I were in college, the word deconstructing wasn't even available to us. But deconstructing is a form of criticism that's based on the premise that if a false narrative about something can be constructed, it can be deconstructed. And throughout modern times now, we've seen that, you know, people like, you know, Shakespeare and subjects like the Civil War, around which there's been lots of, you know, controversy. Modern critics have attempted to kind of go in and deconstruct them, often in a way to offer criticism. And you know, my book about deconstructing Trump is essentially a historical look at the current occupant of the White House through the eyes of historical figures like Plato and Confucius and Shakespeare and, you know, the great thinkers and writers.
Well, I've talked to you, I think, about a couple of your other books. Oxymoronica was one I enjoyed the title of, Paradoxical Wit and Wisdom from History's Greatest Wordsmiths. Why did you choose the current occupant of the White House to, you know, put another book out?
Well, you know, I'm a quotation guy. You're right, I've done eight previous anthologies of quotations on all kinds of topics, from oxymoronic phrasing to metaphorical language and retorts and repartee. And, you know, I've never saw myself as a political partisan. But for me, it all happened very clearly, and many of your listeners will remember this moment, when in July of 2015, then candidate Donald Trump was speaking at an Iowa presidential forum, and he called Senator John McCain a loser and questioned his status as a war hero. And I have always been a great fan of John McCain, and actually believe if he had chosen a different VP as his running mate, he would have gone on to become president. That was a classic error of judgment he made. But, you know, John McCain was a wonderful, wonderful man, and to see, you know, this sort of clownish character get on stage and say this thing about him really bothered me. And about a month later, after that happened, I just happened to be doing my thing. You know, all I do is read great works of literature, looking for wonderful observations about all kinds of topics. And one afternoon, I happened to be reading a new translation of a 1600s play by Molière. And I came across a passage that just stopped me in my tracks. The passage is, "Those who have greatest cause for guilt and shame are quickest to besmirch a neighbor's name." And I read that, and of course my very, very first reaction was, wow, that sounds a lot like Donald Trump, and it sounds almost exactly like what he did last month with Senator John McCain. And so that planted a seed in my brain. It didn't really harvest for a few more months, but I made a mental note, you know, let me be on the lookout for more quotations that, you know, kind of describe this new candidate on the political scene named Donald Trump.
Well, you are, of course, a psychologist by education, now retired. How did you in the first place become such an avid collector and cataloger of quotations?
Well, it all started back in 1963 at the University of North Dakota. I was in the middle of an identity crisis, and I went to see a college counselor, and he suggested I read a book by a guy named Henry David Thoreau, and the way he phrased it was so interesting. He said, "You know, I think Henry David Thoreau was thinking about somebody like you when he wrote his book Walden." And well, that kind of piqued my curiosity, and this psychologist at the counseling center was a big believer in what he called bibliotherapy, and whenever he worked with young struggling men and women who were trying to find their identity, he often got them reading some of the great works of literature. And so at Christmas vacation that year, I read Walden. And it's a kind of a tough read in some ways, but every now and then there are these just absolute gems that kind of shoot right out at you. And as I got near the end of the book, I came across this passage that has become, you know, immortal in world literature. If a man fail to keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer.
Uh-huh.
Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. Well, I mean, I thought that he was talking directly to me when I read those words, so I wrote that passage down on a little 3x5 index card and stored it away. I then went on to reread the entire book, and the second time I read it, I came across even more quotations that I thought were absolutely spectacular, and by the time I finished my second reading, I had about 75 or 80 quotations written down on 3x5 index cards, and that was getting close to 60 years ago, and I'm still doing the same thing today, only I've abandoned the 3x5 index cards, and now I just store them on my computer.
Well, this bibliotherapy you just referenced, is that something you have used as a psychologist since?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it is. You know, one of the things that once I became a practicing psychologist and people started coming to me for problems, I learned a couple of really interesting things. One is that my biggest tool was just being a really good listener. And so when I could create an environment in which people felt safe to explore all of their thoughts and feelings, including some of the darker, you know, more disturbing things that they really didn't want to talk about, you know, that was really useful, because just talking out loud in the presence of a empathic listener is therapeutic. But then every now and then what would happen is, you know, some of these clients would look over at me and say, "Well, you know, thanks for hearing me out, but what do you think?" And that's when things got a little trickier, because when I was in my early 30s, like most psychologists in their early 30s, what did I know? I mean, I didn't have the kind of, you know, grand perspective that I have now in my 70s. And so sometimes I really just stumbled over my own words when I tried to answer these questions. But gradually over time, I began to think to myself, wow, quotations have really helped me. Maybe they'll begin to help some of my clients. And so I began to rather systematically search for quotations that spoke directly to the issues that my clients were wrestling with. For example, this is a perfect example. If ever I had a client who grew up in an alcoholic family, at some point in our working with each other, I would look over at them and say, "You know, there's a female writer who you've never heard of who once wrote these words. It helped me because I grew up in an alcoholic family, and you might find them somewhat useful as well." And she wrote, "Alcoholism is not a spectator sport. Eventually, the whole family gets to play."
Wow.
And that's a powerful bit of phrasing. I mean, it's equally as good as anything Shakespeare ever wrote. And I have shared that particular quotation with maybe now 250 people in my lifetime, and I would say at least 40 or 50 of them have said to me, hold it, I want to write that down. And some of them wrote it down, they took it home, they pasted it up on their refrigerator, and they've kept it there ever since.
Marty Grothy is an author. He collects quotations, and his latest book of quotations is Deconstructing Trump, Donald Trump and the Trump Phenomenon Through the Lens of History. The book, Marty, is organized A to Z by the author's names of these various many, many quotations. None of them directly mention the president. So how did you select these quotations?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, going back to that Molière quote that started it all, you know, after I came across that quotation, maybe a week or two or three later, I came across another wonderful quote from Thomas Carlyle, the famous English writer, and he said, "No sadder proof can be given by a man of his own littleness than disbelief in great men." Well, I mean, this came after the Molière quotation, and it came, you know, 5 weeks after the Ames, Iowa comment about McCain, and again, here was a little man not believing in a great man, and I had another one of those holy mackerel experiences. How could these guys be writing about Trump when they were writing something 200 years earlier? And then all of a sudden, my eyes began to be opened up, I think, to many, many, many more quotations that just seem to bring Trump to mind. Virginia Woolf said, "If you do not tell the truth about yourself, you cannot tell it about other people." Maya Angelou was talking to Oprah Winfrey when she said this. She said, "When people show you who they are, believe them." So basically what happened, very slowly at first, and then more rapidly as the months passed after Donald Trump upset the world, and as well as Hillary Clinton when he won the election, I began to kind of go into high gear. And in part I went into high gear because I was not coping very well with the new emerging reality of a Trump presidency. I've known a lot about Donald Trump from my days as a graduate student in New York in the 1960s and 70s, and you know I followed his career, and you know like so many conservatives back in 2016, you know I didn't take him seriously. He came across as a buffoonish cartoon character. He didn't seem like the kind of person we needed to run the country. And you know, many of your listeners out there will even remember in January of 2016, the National Review, which is the premier at the time, you know, kind of conservative thinking organ, published an issue called Never Trump. And I mean, all of the major conservative thought leaders, Mona Charon and Eric Erickson and Glenn Beck and Thomas Sowell, described Donald Trump as a menace to American conservatism. So I thought, there's no way this guy's going to win the election. And he did, and things have changed since then, haven't they?
Well, I just opened the book to the middle here, and I came across one from Robert Heinlein, a famous science fiction author now passed, but he wrote, "Man is not a rational animal, he is a rationalizing animal."
Well, you know, a rationalization is a very interesting psychological defense mechanism that involves, as the name suggests, it involves finding a rationale for something that deep down inside we know is not really all that acceptable. And so I believe we've seen that happen with, you know, lots and lots of people who 3 or 4 years ago didn't want to have anything to do with Donald Trump and now have actually become rather fervent avid supporters.
Well, you talk about metaphors and similes. These are devices that are used by writers to create a deeper understanding, sort of a shorthand, if you will, that sort of resonates with people. We remember what they said, so then we think about it and all that kind of stuff. And you are looking at this particular president through the lens of history, as you say. History, in the words of wise people long gone, to better understand the present.
Yes, yes. And not just history in this larger historical sense. American history in particular, and the history of the American presidency specifically. I mean, in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt wrote that the presidency is not merely an administrative job. He said, and this is a direct quote, "It is preeminently a place of moral leadership." Mm. Well, I mean, I'm not a Gallup survey type guy, but if I were to take 1,000 randomly selected American adult voters and say to them, "Do you regard President Donald Trump and his presidency as a place of moral leadership?" You know, I don't know how many people would answer yes to that question. We know it would not be half, but it might end up being something like 20%. And to think, is this where we've ended up, that, you know, we now regard the most important job in the entire world and the most important and powerful person in the entire world as a person who is careless with the truth and is not really representing something that we all say we believe in, which is moral leadership, it means that we've arrived at a very disturbing place, I think. There's a wonderful quotation from the French writer George Sand, and she was writing in a letter to a friend around 1850 or so. She said, "We all run the risk of declining. If somebody does not rise to tell us that life is on the heights and not in the cesspools." And, you know, when we talk about the presidents in particular, you know, the greatest presidents have called upon us to rise to the heights. In his first inaugural speech, Abraham Lincoln, you know, talked about the importance of us listening to the better angels of our natures. And there are very few people, I think, even among President Trump's most fervent supporters now, that would say he's a man who's asking us to rise up to the heights and listen to our better angels.
Marty Grothy is the author of the new book, Deconstructing Trump, Donald Trump and the Trump Phenomenon Through the Lens of History. It's available in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound.org, so widely available. You can find out more about what he does with quotations at drmardy.com. And you're also the creator of Dr. Marty's Dictionary of Metaphorical Quotations, a man of many skills. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Doug. I really appreciate your interest.
Harvest Public Media is next.
The things we post on social media can seem trivial, but every now and then, something we say can ignite a firestorm.
Before I would send one of the crazy ones, I'd get a sort of pit in my stomach, that bad feeling when you know you're about to do something stupid.
The post you can't take back, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Trains and barges and ships move grain from the center of the United States to the rest of the world. And even with the challenging growing conditions and tariff barriers, Midwest farmers who grow corn and soybeans are meeting potential buyers from abroad who've come to see their crops. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer caught up with two delegations in Iowa.
On a hot September day, 5 Japanese men arrive at Rod Pierce's Central Iowa farm. They represent feed mills and livestock cooperatives, end users of the corn that ships from farms like this one. Pierce invites them to walk among rows of corn, and he picks one ear and breaks it open.
Okay, see that light-colored area there? That tells how close it is to maturity.
Pierce farms 1,700 acres, planting mostly corn. He knows that about one-fifth of the corn grown in the United States gets exported. But delayed trade deals and tit-for-tat tariffs have cut into some of those sales. Pierce wants these Japanese visitors to keep buying.
I call it a medium to larger size combine.
He invites them to climb into the cab of an 8-head combine and to poke their heads into one of his empty grain storage bins. Pierce has answered their questions all along the way, and now he has one for them.
Do you guys have any problems with our corn as far as quality?
U.S. Grains Council Country Director for Japan, Tommy Hamamoto, translates.
They like corn with higher protein content, but the protein content of U.S. corn is dropping, going down.
Pierce takes this in, says a different seed might lead to higher protein, and he thanks them for the feedback.
So we need to know that and hopefully provide you with the higher protein type corn.
Many U.S. farmers want to focus on retaining global customers, especially as recent waivers for ethanol have spooked the domestic corn market. But George Naylor, who farms in Greene County, Iowa, about an hour from Pierce, doesn't think nurturing international sales is the right way forward. After decades of free trade deals, he says his grain doesn't fetch a higher price.
I'm still getting very bad prices. Below the cost of production.
In the late 1970s, Naylor once served on the Iowa Corn Promotion Board, which helped coordinate the Japanese visit to the Iowa farm. But Naylor says he eventually decided the emphasis on exports and free trade deals didn't improve his bottom line or U.S. agriculture in general. Instead, he feels it helped agribusinesses get bigger and ultimately gave too much influence to one buyer.
So it's actually China that's determining the outcome of our farm economy by levying these tariffs and scaring the market.
After decades as a conventional corn and soybean farmer, Naylor recently transitioned fields to organic and added oats, some hay, and an apple orchard to his enterprise. He's worried, though, about his struggling neighbors who rent land and continue to depend on the global marketplace.
You can see some of our top markets here. Obviously, Mexico, our neighbor to the south, being number one, Japan and Korea yourselves, and then Peru and Colombia.
At the Iowa Corn Promotion Board office in suburban Des Moines, T.J. Page presents Iowa corn facts to a delegation from South Korea. These men ask about the quality of Iowa corn this season. Jim Greif is one of three farmers who came to meet the delegation. He welcomed the visit as a way to assuage some fears about the crop that's about to be harvested.
Well, there's been a lot of press, and there is a potential problem with, you know, finishing this crop out. But here in Iowa, we're going to have a fair crop. And I think we was able to convey that we're going to have plenty of corn and there'll be plenty of good quality of corn for shipment to countries like Korea.
Greif visited South Korea on a trade delegation. He says he knows buyers can get corn from other places and it's in his interest to keep them coming back for more U.S. corn. But that doesn't mean he'll favor exports over other options. In northeast Iowa, where he farms, he can sell corn to processors for starch or sweeteners, to ethanol plants, or to an exporter.
Within 50 miles of my place, I can pick one of the markets. And of course, I'm like most farmers, whichever one's paying the most is the one going to get the corn.
That's a philosophy almost any business owner will recognize. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks at America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, a natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura, and an interview with a science student and his teacher about promising research into a serious soil contamination problem. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The time clock is ticking. We're looking at a strong change in our weather here coming up at the end of the week, and they're actually saying the S word out loud at the Weather Service.
After seeing 5 inches of rain in the city of Grand Forks Friday night, County Emergency Manager Carrie Gels says an all-out effort is being made to get water-damaged items removed from homes.
We're getting calls mostly from elderly and disabled people that can't get down in the basement to get this stuff out. It's over 72 hours into the event, so, you know, mold is going to begin growing, and this is going to become a health issue. So we are signing up volunteers as fast as we can and hope to, by evening or early tomorrow, we hope to be able to deploy volunteer teams to some of these homes to help them pull stuff out of their basements.
Gell says as a response to the flooding, they've activated the recently formed COAD, or Community Organizations Active in Disasters. She calls it a small army that backs the Emergency Management Office with a lot of expertise.
We have organizations from as far away as Bemidji that have joined our COAD. And then when we get requests in to our office, so say we have a family right now who was in a first floor apartment that got flooded. The management company is taking care of the apartment, but this gentleman has two small kids, and it's not safe for him to try and live in that apartment while it's being renovated. So we reach out to the Red Cross because they have the housing mission, and they will get in touch now with that apartment person, and they will figure out a plan for some short-term housing while their apartment is being renovated.
Gell says the COAD and the services the group deliver are part of being a whole community. She says the resilience will be key as people come together to help in the recovery effort. A Fargo man who killed one of his sons and seriously injured another son in a drunken driving crash last March has pleaded guilty. 31-year-old Christopher Devine will be sentenced after a criminal background investigation. He faces up to 20 years in prison on the most serious charges.
He entered guilty pleas, what we call open guilty pleas in these cases, so we'll be making sentencing arguments to the judge. They will do a background check on him. They will also thoroughly review the police reports and witness statements, and then probation will give a recommendation as to the sentence they feel is appropriate with all of that information, and then make our recommendations.
Assistant Cass County State's Attorney Ryan Youngren. Devine's 7-year-old son died in the crash on South University Drive. His 5-year-old son was badly hurt and spent weeks in the hospital. And Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says he is concerned about the agriculture economy and what impact the current situation in farming might have on the community.
As you know, Fargo, we have multi-different entities that help to keep it a vibrant economy. But, I mean, if our farmers get hurt much more, that's going to hurt us as well. And I think we'll see an impact.
Mahoney says because of the diversity, the city continues to do well. But he says agriculture is still king in the Red River Valley. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Carrion flower is a descriptive name that gets attention, and it's the subject of Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota essay. It's a bit surprising to me that I'd never heard of the carrion flower until Chuck introduced it, and it's a reminder that we can live in a place for a long time and still discover fascinating things around us.
It's about this time of year that I occasionally get a question about a plant with a tight cluster of dark blue berries in Turtle Mountain. Although there are a few options, it's often carrion flower, or Smilax herbacea, the plants in the catbriar family. Carrion flower is a native herbaceous climbing vine. The plant produces alternate oval-shaped leaves that are 3 to 4 inches long and 2 to 3 inches wide with smooth margins. Unlike most leaves that have straight veins, some of the veins of carrion flower are curved. They're quite distinctive, as are the tendrils at the base of the leaf stalks. Carrion flower can be found in woods and thickets across our region. It's well documented in North and South Dakota. Many range maps, however, show it growing east of a line from Ontario and Minnesota southward to Texas, plus Oklahoma and Kansas. Carrion flower is dioecious, which means that there are separate male and female plants. Neither the male or female flowers are showy, but as the name implies, the female flowers have a smell similar to that of rotten meat. As you might expect, the flowers are pollinated by flies. Although carrion flower is certainly not rare, it's seldom noticed by the casual observer during the summer months. However, come fall, when the leaves are starting to turn color and the blue clusters of berries is in stark contrast to the surrounding foliage, it can be quite conspicuous. The dark blue to almost black berries are produced in a tight-looking cluster that are about the size of choke cherries. Once a person has seen these berries and the leaves of the plant, it's easily recognized. I've been told that the fruits of carrion flower are poisonous, but a quick check of some reference books revealed otherwise. Apparently, the fruits are edible and have a pleasant taste. The Lakota ate the berries as a snack. And a few people make jam and jelly from the berries, although it might be difficult to find enough of them to make the effort worthwhile. Carrion flower is starting to gain interest among gardeners as an ornamental. The climbing habit, interesting foliage, and colorful fruits can provide an interesting contrast to that of the usual flower gardens, particularly during fall. Seeds are commercially available, or you could simply collect some ripe fruits and sow the seeds in some good soil and partial shade. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. North Dakota's biggest industries are ag and oil, and they can impact one another negatively when spilled processed water from fracking makes land unusable for growing crops. Freshman Evan Canol is a science whiz at Park Christian School in Moorhead. The brine water problem intrigues him, and he spent a few of his young years trying to devise a solution. He thinks the ag industry may be able to use certain plants to help clean up the soil. Canol was recently named a semifinalist in the Broadcom Masters STEM competition, one of 300 students nationwide. He spoke with Ashley Thornburg about his project, which he titled, Don't Be So Salty, the Remediation of Brine Contaminated Soil Through the Use of Phytoremediation.
And what do those words mean?
So brine is a wastewater byproduct of oil and gas drilling that can be up to 10 times saltier than seawater. And when it's spilled in soil, it creates like a desert-like scenario where plants can't grow because of the high salinity. And I'm using plants in a process called phytoremediation to extract the salts from the soil so other less salt-tolerant plants can eventually be planted there.
How did you get interested in this?
So I was actually looking at oil spills and how to figure out a way to help with those. So I was looking at like rocks that would soak up oil spills, like scoria. And then I talked to people at NDSU, and Dr. Thomas DeSutter, he talked to me about cover crops and brine spills. Like, I also did research, and I saw, like, brine spills were very prevalent, especially in our area where oil drilling is huge. So then I started my first year, and that was just using one type of cover, like, that was just using one type of plant called cover crops.
And how are these working? Because I know in farming with a cover crop, oftentimes with intensive monoculturing, the cover crop just replaces nutrients that have been stripped out. Is this a case of they're stripping out the salt and that's it, or are they adding things back in as well?
So they're using the salts to supplement other nutrients that they needed for in the plants to survive. And they're, overall, they're helping like keep the soil from eroding, adding like nutrients into the soil. So they're helping the overall health, not just the salinity.
What kind of plants are you using?
I'm using three types of plants. This last year I used weeds, halophytes, and cover crops. And the cover crops I used were rye, barley, crested wheatgrass, fava beans, and alfalfa. And the halophytes I used were salty cress, and the weed I used was foxtail barley, which is very common in our area. And this year I added orach, which is a halophyte.
And what is a halophyte?
A halophyte is a type of like salt-tolerant plant that has a very good salt tolerance, which sometimes halophytes are planted along the ocean because they can survive in very, very high salinity areas.
Right. So you said this year you added. How long have you been doing this?
This is my third year doing science fair.
And always on this
always
theme?
Always on brine spills.
How have the projects changed over the years?
So I originally just started with just four cover crops, you know, just three replications and five salt levels. And the next year, I got up to 8 salt levels, and I used 3 different soil types. I also used a chemical treatment, and I got actual brine spill soil. And, yeah, I also cut it with sand to see how drainage would affect.
Where did you get your, well, specifically the brine soil?
I didn't get, like, I don't know the specific site, but it was from a brine spill near the Bakken region.
And how are the different crops performing? Is there sort of a surprise winner here?
Well, my first year I thought rye would actually do the best because it has a very fibrous root system. And I thought, you know, from all of my research, I thought rye was going to easily beat the others. But every year I've done it so far, I found that barley has way surpassed the others in results.
What are you going to do with your results?
Well, I honestly don't know. I mean, yeah, I've talked to other professors about it, and, you know, some have suggested trying to get published, but I don't know, that'd be pretty cool, but I don't know what to do yet.
Are there a lot of ninth graders who get published?
Not many that I know of.
Well, I'm really intrigued by the entire theme and the arc of your science fair projects being very problem-focused. Like, yes, you could have a science that just does something cool, but then you have this other element of a scientific discovery that goes on to have an environmental impact and something that does good for the people in the world.
Well, yeah, I'm wanting to help because our area, you know, there's so many farmers, and when a brine spill, you know, you can't control a brine spill, so it can happen anywhere, and it can ruin the soil unless you fix it. And right now, the main remediation methods are dumping huge amounts of water, which we don't have unlimited fresh water. So that's going to just create more problems. Mm-hmm. And the other method is digging out the soil. And, again, not solving the problem because, you know, soil isn't going to last forever. Mm-hmm. We only have so much of these resources.
Have you ever tried intermixing? Like, what would happen if you did rye and barley at the same time? Like, you're supposed to grow tomatoes and basil together because they repel each other's bugs.
I've never actually tried that, but yeah, I've, like, trying to breed the plants together could help. But that's an interesting idea.
Well, if you get published, you know, just put co. Yeah. That's all I ask.
Yeah.
Well, who's this woman sitting next to you?
This is my science teacher, Mrs. Holter, sorry.
Recently married, yeah. Mrs. Holter. Congratulations. How long have you been involved with Evan's projects?
In seventh grade, he actually had a different teacher, but I still supervise all of our science research at Park Christian. So really all 3 years now. But last year was I was a lot more involved than his seventh grade year because I teach eighth grade science.
What do you think of this project?
I love this idea. One of the things that we really try to focus on is to get students to solve the world's problems. And even this summer, I listened to a story that out in the Bakken that they don't know how to get plants to grow. And I sent Evan's mom a text message that said, hey, Evan's project, he needs to contact these companies. And so there's more than just getting him published. This is something that commercially we could use that companies can benefit from. And he has contacted some of the oil companies and they've sent him things because he's in support of making sure that, yes, we need mining and we need natural resources, but we need to be good stewards of what we've been given. And being able to bioremediate anything gives us a lot of potential there. So
that must feel pretty cool as a teacher to get a student who not just has this potential to get published, but is getting recognition in a real life application. You see so many high school recent graduates who are like, geez, I'm sure glad I don't know how to do my taxes, but I know the Pythagorean theorem. And we complain about there being not real world applications for what we learn in school. And you're kind of doing this the other way around.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, is a buzzword with teaching is being a 21st century, you know, school. And one of the things that we have really worked at is to provide opportunities for students to learn outside of just regular school stuff. And I do consider this very 21st century skill, being able to communicate the way he does and write and meet with adults that are, he works with professors, and they're always just amazed at the abilities of our students. And every 7th, 8th, and 10th grade student at our school puts a science fair project together. They're not all like Evans, but they're all something that students are working towards, and it's a great feeling. I love it. Sometimes I have to remind myself that I love it when, you know, it's October and they're doing research, and really nobody loves to do research. They like to do the experimenting part, but I love watching kids just learn, and we've had students that have gone on to scholarships because of what they've done in science, and they're working in a field and learning all of these different things. It's just the opportunities there that they wouldn't have if they didn't get to do science research.
Well, speaking of this recognition, and you said scholarships, and then there's also sometimes you get picked up by things like the top 300 list. Tell us about what this is.
So we compete at a regional level, and then if students are selected, they can go on to the Minnesota State Science Fair, and the top 10% of those students get the opportunity to apply to a Broadcom Masters Science Fair program for middle school, or the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair if you're in high school. And Evan received a gold medal at State last year in April and was able to apply for Broadcom Masters. So he was then selected just a couple of weeks ago as one of the top 300 students in the nation for his research. And Park Christian has had three students that have made this semifinal round, which for a little school in Moorhead, Minnesota, is crazy huge statistics that we are doing well.
How's that feel, Evan?
It feels pretty great to be able to be on that list, you know. Top 300 of anything is super cool.
Did you have an inkling? Your teacher mentioned it's an application process. Did you think you were going to get in?
Well, actually, I barely made state because I became alternate at regionals. So that was a surprise. You know, I was hoping to make it to state. But then at state, they let me go. And then top 5% at the state. So I was just hoping just to make it. So I had no idea this would go that well.
An alternate at regionals, and then gold medal at state, and then selected into this. What's that tell you about that first hurdle that you might face in scientific research?
Well, I didn't expect it, you know, because I had put a lot of work into my project. So, you know, I was kind of thinking, you know, you did the work. Let's see how it goes. But, yeah, it was tough, you know.
What does a selection like this mean for students?
There's not a lot of... There's not a lot. Like, you don't get money, and you don't, not yet. But it's definitely something that on a college application, I was selected at this level. He does really have the potential to be published because he was a top 300 Broadcom Masters semifinalist.
When we say published, what are we talking here? What level?
Well, so there are scientific journals out there that will take your research that you do, and it will be published in a journal. I've had a few students over the years that have actually been published for their research at school. So it's his older sister actually also loves science fair, and she's a senior this year, and she's currently working on publication for her project. So, it's just like if you were in college and you were a professor and you're getting your work published, it's the same exact journals. It's the same peer review process. It's just instead of being an adult, you're not.
And does having three selected from such a small school, like you mentioned, does that change anything for your school?
You know, we have always just felt that we want to give students opportunities to be able to not just be good at sports or just be good at the normal things. And we are really the only school in Fargo-Moorhead that is still actively doing scientific research in the junior high and high school level. And we've had, you know, people are like, I don't want to do this. And I just keep coming back to the students' opportunities. Not every kid wants to go to college. Not every kid needs to go to college. But if that's a potential for you, I want to provide that opportunity for you. And that's how I feel about science research. If this is a gift that you have and you are good at researching, what a cool opportunity to find out in middle school that this is something you like. It's also great to find out, I had a student that found out that they did not want to be a microbiologist because of their science fair project. And they were hugely successful, but they found out that that's not for them. And that saved them thousands of dollars in college alone. So there's so much good that comes out of it that, but as far as our school, it's part of who we are. It's part of our identity that we are going to get kids to do science research.
When you have this unique challenge as an educator, especially in this time period, to be teaching for careers that do not exist and that are difficult to even imagine 10 years mm-hmm. ago that these would have been jobs.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I just want them to be able to be successful at skills, because if you have a skill, it doesn't matter what your job is, you can do that anywhere. And if our students can communicate, if they know how to write, and if they can do research, it doesn't matter if you're going to be everybody needs to communicate, everybody needs to write, everybody needs to be able to do a little research, fact check some things once in a while. So that's, I mean, yes, I'm a science teacher. I teach chemistry and I teach physics and I teach science research, but I don't really teach science research. I mean, it's, hey, this is what you're going to do. I don't know the answers. You guys go figure out the answers on your own. And it's really, really fun because I don't have to learn. I didn't know any of the stuff about Evan's project, but I do now because he's communicated it with me. And that's always fun. I get to learn from my students.
That's great. Have you seen a change in how you approach other classes at all? I know you're only a freshman, but just in especially that sort of hands-on learning and the ability to apply this to something that you see in the world, does this change how you approach any of your other non-science classes?
Totally. I'll look at assignments that look daunting, but then I'll think of science fair, and, you know, it makes it seem way easier.
That's not the answer I was expecting, but it's so much better. What's next for you, Evan?
I do not know. I'm just going to keep trying, like Mrs. Holter said, to do as much as I can so I can have opportunities to do what I want in the future.
Well, good fortune to you.
Thank you.
Thank you also for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking to him. We just love that you were able to do that.
That was Evan Canole, a freshman, and Krista Holter, a science teacher at Park Christian in Moorhead, talking with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 23rd. There was a great deal of excitement in Devil's Lake on this date in 1910. Dan Brennan of the law firm Brennan and Brennan had been shot following a raid to clean up the city's blind pigs and bawdy houses. Citizens of Devil's Lake were concerned after several months of steadily increasing crime. They blamed city officials for allowing crime to flourish, with officials involved with protection rackets and corruption. They put the blame on Mayor P.J. McClory and Police Chief Barnes. They said both men knew the city was going to rack and ruin, but did nothing to stop it. It was said that illegal drinking establishments, known as blind pigs, operated as openly in Devil's Lake as any licensed saloon. Gamblers had also invaded the city, operating games of chance, but the games were fixed, and the gamblers took advantage of the locals. It was common knowledge that a building advertising furnished rooms was actually a bawdy house. A cold storage house supplied cold beer, which could even be delivered to local homes. Prominent citizens and businessmen banded together with the acting state's attorney, Fred Traynor, to address what had become an intolerable situation. Together, they planned a raid to put an end to the illegal activity. After Traynor secured warrants, Sheriff Belford deputized a number of men. They were successful in making numerous arrests. Four men were arrested for distributing beer. Nellie Rogers was arrested for running a house of ill repute, and a variety of gamblers and proprietors of blind pigs were also hauled in. After assisting with the raid, attorney Dan Brennan stopped at his office before returning home. As he left, he heard someone in the dark vestibule. When he felt a revolver against his chest, he dodged aside. The bullet hit him in the arm. He drew his own pistol and fired, but missed. The man escaped out a window. Brennan ran out and saw someone race away down an alley. Another attorney in the building roused the police to report the shooting. Brennan's wound wasn't serious, and the doctor arrived to treat him. The day fortunately ended with no fatalities. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Patty Namond, Health Policy Correspondent. NPR is a pioneer, one of the first news organizations to cover health care, taking the initiative to look thoughtfully and thoroughly at a medical system that excels in science but often fails to deliver fairness and efficiency. NPR is on the cutting edge. Always has been. This is NPR.
Where are we?
Secret place.
A man who was tortured in Bashar al-Assad's prisons is finally free.
They killed my dad, my brothers, my cousins. They still kill him.
Now the most visible witness to Syria's secret system of arrest and torture is determined to bring his captors to justice. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street. It may not have been on your calendar. It wasn't on mine, but this is Bioplastics Week. NDSU is a lead site to research bioplastics like plant pots that are biodegradable. And tomorrow on our show, we'll talk about this emerging industry with NDSU's David Gruel. And the second annual North Dakota LGBTQ Plus Summit will feature the Breaking Barriers Oral History Project, undertaken by the Red River Rainbow Seniors. We'll share another excerpt from that project on our show Tuesday. So join us for Main Street, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.